This was also way before people like Bullard and other famous black expats went to Paris and other places in Western Europe, which happened mostly right after the First World War. What makes him, of course, completely amazing is that he was able to use his skills as a waiter and a valet, which he had become even in the United States, to become one of the biggest entrepreneurs in Imperial Moscow in terms of popular entertainment.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Frederick Bruce Thomas was born in 1872 to former slaves and spent his youth on his family's prosperous farm in Mississippi. That his ex-slave parents were able to be prosperous is a story in and of itself. But after a resentful, rich white planter's attempt to steal their land forced them to escape to Memphis, Frederick's father was then brutally murdered by another black man and the family disintegrated. After leaving the South and working as a waiter and valet in Chicago and Brooklyn, Frederick went to London in 1894 and traveled throughout Europe and finally decided to go to Russia in 1899, where essentially no black American had gone. But to his surprise, Frederick found no color line in Russia and made Moscow his home. During the next 19 years, he renamed himself Fyodor Fyodorovich Thomas, married twice to Russian women, acquired a mistress, took Russian citizenship, and by dint of his talents, hard work, charm, and guile, became one of the city's richest and most famous owners of variety theaters and restaurants. Then the Bolshevik Revolution happened, which ruined him because he was considered prosperous and part of the bourgeoisie, and he barely escaped with his life and family to Turkey in 1919, when at the time it was the Ottoman Empire and crumbling. Starting with just a handful of dollars out of the millions he lost, Frederick made a second fortune in Constantinople by opening a series of celebrated nightclubs that introduced jazz to the Ottomans. But because of the long arm of American racism, the xenophobia of the new Turkish Republic, and his own extravagance, he fell on hard times, was thrown into debtor's prison, and died in Constantinople in 1928. Well, his story is fascinating, and although he was widely known during his lifetime, Frederick Thomas is virtually forgotten. The few references to him that have been published during the past 80 years are brief and often wrong. Today's guest is here to correct the record. He's Vladimir Alexandrov, and he's a previous guest on the show, and he's author of the book The Black Russian. He's researched Thomas's life and shows that through his intelligence, he was able to escape the constraints of his humble origins and being black in the United States. He went from rags to riches twice, but as a consequence of the revolutionary transformations happening in the places where he lived, he ultimately ended his life in ruin. But despite the low note that he ends his life on, there's a lot to be inspired by his legacy, and I think it's something that deserves to be rediscovered. So I hope you enjoyed this exploration of the fascinating life of Frederick Thomas with our guest Vladimir Alexandrov. Vladimir, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, last time we had a very interesting discussion about the Bolshevik Revolution and how the narrative wasn't nearly as clean as it's been portrayed, and you as a specialist know this very well. We're going to do something else in this episode, and I'm very excited because it combines a lot of things that I like, and those are historical figures that complicate the narratives we think we know, and it ties it into Reconstruction America and the Ottoman Empire. You can't usually say that you have all those things in one episode, but that's what we're going to do. And all of this is done through the life of someone whom I had never heard about, Frederick Bruce Thomas, who, as you argue, was a very influential social figure in the twilight of the Ottoman Empire and was well known among many people, but I had never heard about him, and that's true for many today. So, first of all, how did you discover him? Why do you think he was forgotten, and how did you reconstruct his story?
Sure. I love remembering this, even though it all happened a few years ago, because it was an event and a process that literally changed my life. I was preparing to teach a graduate seminar on Russian culture between the two world wars. And I wanted to do an episode or a class on Alexander Virginsky, who was a very popular singer in the late imperial period in the 20s and 30s in the emigration, and was still popular today. And I was reading his memoir where he described how after he escaped from the south of Russia to get away from the Bolsheviks, he landed in Constantinople, which was a safe haven for a lot of Russians during the Russian Civil War because it was in the hands of the Allies. And he mentioned, Virtinsky did, that he began to perform, as he put it in his original Russian, in the outdoor entertainment garden named Stella that belonged to our famous Moscow Negro, Fyodor Fyodorovich Thomas. And I remember this surprised me so much that I closed the book and put it down because I knew something about the period, and I knew that Black people of any kind were extremely rare in Imperial Russia. And as I like to tell people, if you ask an average educated Russian to name the most famous Black person in Russian imperial history, they'll mention a figure from the 18th century, Abram Hannibal. And he's remembered because he's the great-great-grandfather of Alexander Pushkin, Russia's national poet. But he lived in the 18th century, so there were no others. Anyway, this so fascinated me that I started to dig. One thing led to another. I eventually wound up doing research in five different countries, in archives and in libraries. And I discovered that this man that Virtinsky referred to in the way that he did was really named not Fyodor Fyodorovich Thomas, which is the Russian version of his name that was used, but Frederick Bruce Thomas, that he was born to former slaves in Cahoma County, Mississippi in 1872. And then by following one strand after another, I was able to reconstruct his life fully enough to write his biography. So the question is, why was he forgotten? There were several reasons. Americans were not interested in preserving the memory of successful Black people abroad, even if they originally came from the United States. And Thomas expatriated himself from the United States in 1894 and never came back home. He died in 1928, so it was a long time. The Russian Empire, where Thomas became famous enough for the singer Virtinsky to refer to him the way that he did, collapsed, as we know, in 1917. And there was no interest among the new Soviet overlords to preserve figures from the world of popular entertainment, which is where Frederick Bruce Thomas left his mark. And the same kind of thing happened in Turkey. Thomas got there in 1919. In 1923, the Turkish Republic was proclaimed after the wars that Atatürk had to fight against the Greeks and the Allies and so on. And Turkey began to swing away from this kind of indulgent treatment of foreigners that it used to have under the Ottomans, as a result of which Thomas also was forgotten in the new modern Turkey that the Turks were building under Atatürk. So all the places where he could have been remembered basically started to wash their hands of him. And it was only because he left a paper trail that I was able to find him.
And it's not convenient for people to have to reconstruct this paper trail in multiple languages. I'm sure if it were all in one language or all in English, it would have been written. But anyway, it made it good for you.
Yeah, and that was terrific because the search for information about him and the more information I found, the more fascinated I became with the figure and the more eager I was to pursue the detective-like hunt that I was carrying out. You know, I would find something crucial in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., because, for example, when Thomas was in Constantinople, he had dealings with the American Consulate General there following 1918. And it was my great good fortune that the Consulate General in Constantinople, which is in the center of the city, was in those days, had clerks who kept every last scrap of paper from those days. So I found volumes, big folio volumes of different sized documents, letters, and all kinds of other stuff in the National Archives. And when I went to look into the French National Archives, I found surprising things there, found things in the Russian National Archives. The one place where I didn't find anything, and I had to hire researchers to help me, was in Turkish archives. I don't know Turkish, much less Ottoman, the language in which the documents were composed until, 1928, when the modern version of Turkish was instituted. I hired several researchers who looked in whatever archives looked plausible, and they all said there's nothing. If it had only been one researcher, I wouldn't have been so sure. But since several said the same thing, I'm assuming that there is nothing there of any significance. But I did rely on published sources from Turkey. As you know, French was the second language of the Ottoman Empire. And there were newspapers published in Istanbul and Constantinople in French. I was able to get those in the National Library in Paris, which had a full run. And I found some other documents that friendly specialists pointed me toward that were Turkish reminiscences of Thomas. So I was able to piece together quite a bit.
Right. You're the first guest who's starting to get my gears spinning about the Ottoman archives. I hope I don't go down the rabbit trail. But my intuition experience tells me you're right, that unless he did anything terribly illegal, he probably would have merited mention. But I'm sure the papers that focused on that quarter of the city where most of the international residents resided would have mentioned him, as you said. Well, this reminds me of someone else who appeared on this podcast, and that was Eugene Jacques Boulard, who was another Black American who left the United States in the late 19th century, went to France. He was a pilot for the French Foreign Legion, and also his ambition was too strong for the possibilities of Jim Crow era United States, so he sought his fortune abroad.
Yeah, I read a biography of him. I read his biography. Yeah.
So I recommend listeners check out that episode too. But looking at Frederick, his parents were remarkable in their own right because they became prosperous in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War in Mississippi. So could you tell me about them and Frederick's upbringing?
Sure. I think that Frederick got his wings from his parents, as it were. The remarkable life that he led was inspired by them. They had been slaves, both of them, but in 1869, Frederick's father bought at auction a large tract of land in Cahoma County for very little money and became a great success as a farmer. So that in 1870, during the national census that was conducted, his property holdings were evaluated at some $5,870, whereas he had paid $20 for the tract of land that he bought. So in other words, he managed through his hard work as a farmer to launch himself into the farming elite of Cahoma County. Moreover, he was in the leading group of liberated Black people because even after the Civil War, the vast majority of the land was still owned by whites. Very few Blacks owned anything. And his was one of the biggest Black-owned farms in that county. There's evidence that Frederick Thomas was born on that farm in 1872. There's evidence that Frederick's parents founded a school on their property in a church, a chapel that they had built, an African Methodist Episcopal chapel. And we know that these kinds of places of worship served various functions into the 20th century in Black communities, including educational and social ones. So Thomas got the rudiments of an education there. The family was so prominent that a rich white planter, when Reconstruction was ending, tried to steal their farm from them. The parents showed their mettle by fighting him in court and winning some of the early phases of the legal struggle. This wasn't because white lawyers wanted to defend the Black family against a rich white planter, as much as the fact that white lawyers were competing against each other, and one of them used the Thomas case to attack a rival. But the point is that the Thomases fought back. Eventually, things got too hot for them, and they had to move to Memphis to get out of harm's way, which is where Thomas was exposed to urban life for the first time in a way that marked him for the rest of his life. And then just briefly to summarize the curve or the arc of his life, he went north very early on in 1890, which is way before the Great Migration began, when hundreds of thousands of Black people sought opportunity in the north and came there from the south. He worked first in Chicago and then in Brooklyn, which had minuscule Black populations in the early 1890s. And then what made him even more unusual was he decided to go to Europe to seek his fortune. This was also way before people like Bullard and other famous Black expats went to Paris and other places in Western Europe, which happened mostly right after the First World War. What makes him, of course, completely amazing is that he was able to use his skills as a waiter and a valet, which he had become even in the United States, to become one of the biggest entrepreneurs in Imperial Moscow in terms of popular entertainment by making a lot of money as a very successful maitre d'hotel in a very famous restaurant called the Yar. He and a couple of Russian partners bought a failed entertainment garden in the center of Moscow. Incidentally, it still exists, and it's still called the same. It's called the Aquarium. And they turned it around. Moreover, the company that they founded was known in Russian periodicals of the 19-teens, I'm talking about 1911, 12, 13, 14, as Thomas and Company. He was the leading figure in his group, and he made so much money that he was able to open a second place that he ran on his own. So he became very quickly very prominent in Russian popular entertainment circles. He became a citizen of the Russian Empire during the First World War, possibly the first and only Black American to achieve that status, if we want to call it that, although I think he probably did it for practical reasons. Russia was fighting a world war. He wanted to show his loyalty to the country that had adopted him. And the problems that he faced all came with the Bolsheviks when they took over. They didn't care that Thomas was a representative of an oppressed minority in the United States. All they cared about him was that he had become a rich bourgeois, and thereby automatically an enemy of their draconian regime. So in 1918, he had to flee for his life, which is the beginning of the journey that leads eventually to Constantinople in 1919.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. For many reasons, he blazes a trail that few, perhaps none, had taken. And I wonder, what caused him to emigrate from the South? I mean, I can understand after the period of Reconstruction, then the Iron Curtain of Jim Crow descends upon the South. So it's understandable, as you say, he does this before the Great Migration North by many other Black Americans. But why does he do this before then? And do you know why he goes to Europe and then eventually Russia? Is he simply following a trail of opportunity or some other reason?
I think that the catalyst for his leaving the South was the fact that his family fell apart in Memphis. His parents tried to make a living after they left their farm in Cahoma County, where the legal process was still unrolling and would continue for a number of other years. Now, they continued to fight the white landowner, but they, as I said, they needed to get out of harm's way. They opened a boarding house in Memphis, and because Thomas's father, Lewis, was a very decent man based on all the records, he got involved in a domestic dispute with a tenant defending the wife against the man, and that man murdered him. I thought when I first came across this that this was some kind of a hidden maneuver by the white landowner in Cahoma to get back at Frederick Bruce Thomas's father, but there's no evidence for that. It was simply bad luck. That was what led Thomas to decide to take off on his own. By then he was 18 years old. Memphis was a major railway hub for the entire South, with railway lines running north and south as well. And he was taken with the sight of trains running off into distant, appealing directions. And I think he developed a wanderlust, as he said it later, which is why he went to Chicago. It was a booming city full of skyscrapers, full of emigres, opportunity. He left Chicago, I think, in 1893 because the city was particularly hard hit by an economic depression that was unrolling in the country at the time and hit the Midwest particularly badly. He went to Brooklyn because, you know, where's a Chicagoan going to go if he wants some place bigger and better than Chicago? New York. Although Brooklyn at the time wasn't actually a part of the city. So what made him go to Europe? In the New York area, he worked as a waiter and a valet, but he also had an interest in music. Specifically, I believe it was singing. I've inferred that from various kinds of evidence. He had a German teacher in Manhattan who advised him that he has to go to Europe because otherwise the color line would prevent him from advancing. And it was intentionally with that reason that Thomas decided to go to London initially, where he didn't succeed in enrolling in a conservatory. Which also means to me that he probably wasn't that committed to the idea of a vocal career of some sort, because he was such a motivated individual that had he really wanted to do it, he would have found a way. So he reverted to what he knew. He knew how to be a waiter and a valet. He was so good at it, in fact, that he was made the captain of waiters in a resort hotel in the Riviera in about 1892 or so. In other words, he was put in charge of native French and local Italian waiters in this hotel. So he was obviously very good at what he was doing. He went to Monte Carlo because he said he wanted to learn Italian. He was on his way to Milan. But in Monte Carlo, he apparently ran into a rich Russian. Now, the story of who this rich Russian was varied with Thomas's recollections. Sometimes he said it was a Russian Grand Duke. It's possible. Monaco is certainly on the radar for Russian nobility and rich Russians like anyone else. And it's possible that Thomas wound up being hired as a valet by a rich Russian who took him with him to St. Petersburg. And after working there for a while, Thomas decided to look over the country, went to Odessa, went to Moscow, and chose Moscow as the place to put down roots. Why that is, I also have a speculative reason. Moscow turns out around 1900 to have been really a multi-ethnic city. I mean, the Russian Empire straddled Asia and Europe. Two-thirds of the Russian Empire lay in Asia, if you take the Urals as the dividing line between Europe and Asia. There were people in Moscow from all over the Black Sea Basin, from Central Asia, as well as from Western Europe. So if you look at a travel guide published for British and American visitors to the Russian Empire in 1914, it will tell you that the site of city streets in central Moscow was a very motley one, with people of all kinds of ethnic backgrounds, which means that although Thomas was very rare statistically as a black man, there were hardly any in Russia, as I mentioned before, there were lots of people around who looked exotic and who had dark skin. So he didn't stand out nearly as much as his actual rarity would indicate. I think he found it easy to blend in. And in the research that I did about his life in Moscow, I didn't find a single racist comment about him, even when he became prominent. People referred to him as being black, and there were some nasty comments about him by competitors in the fairly competitive popular entertainment business, but it wasn't based on race. And as he subsequently remembered, when he was already in Constantinople and met American tourists, he said there was no color line in Russia. That's why he stayed there, and he wound up living in Moscow longer than anywhere else in his life, except for the family farm back in Mississippi.
That's an interesting point, and something I've read many times is that the Russian Empire had a larger Muslim population than the Ottoman Empire did. That speaks partly to the size of the Russian Empire, but also that they conquered traditionally Muslim lands, the Volga River Basin, but then along with Central Asia. And for those who don't have a geographic understanding of the Russian Empire, it encompassed all of the so-called Stan countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, etc. And I wonder that he didn't face racial animus. Was that because as a black man, he was simply so exotic that people didn't have a mental category, in the way that when I grew up in a small town in Iowa, no one ever made derogatory comments about Polynesians? That's not because, you know, there was no bias anywhere. It's that people just simply didn't think about Polynesians because they didn't encounter any Polynesians. Was it that, or was most of the hostility class-based, in the way that the troubled history in America was race-based? Or what do you think is the reason for that?
I think it was because there were so few black people that there was no animus that had developed against them. In the 1960s, the Soviets did some massive outreach toward third world countries in Africa and Asia, and they even founded a so-called People's Friendship University in Moscow, named after Patrice Lumumba, a figure from the history of the Congo. Once large numbers of black African students came to Moscow, racism appeared. So it wasn't that the Russians were somehow inoculated a priori and always against racism. It's just that in Thomas's day, there weren't enough black people for there to be any kind of a widespread reaction. And look, the Russians were notoriously anti-Semitic at the time when Thomas was there. And it was basically written into the way things were done in the Russian Empire, with all kinds of repressions and limitations on what Jewish people could do. So the Russians had their perceived hated enemies. It's just that Black people were not among them. And you mentioned Central Asia. The skin color of various peoples from Central Asia and their different kinds, from the Caucasus, from Siberia, really varied. So it was not the case that Black dark skin was by itself a mark of anything specific. There were too many different kinds of dark-skinned individuals who had been integrated to varying, frequently highly sophisticated degrees into Russian imperial society for anyone to make a big deal out of Thomas's black skin. I mean, the situation at that time wasn't really all that different in Western Europe either. In the 1890s, in London and Paris, black people were still quite rare, and there was no animus against them. It's a curious detail that I discovered. You know, American tourists would go to London and Paris in the 1890s, then they come home, and they would write a letter to the editor of their local newspaper someplace in Cleveland or somewhere, saying, you know, I had a great trip to London. The one thing that really amazed me and annoyed me was that I went to a fancy restaurant and I saw a black man having dinner with a white woman, and nobody cared. So in other words, the Americans brought their racism to Europe with them in their baggage. But the Europeans were not specifically at that time anti-black. Again, the Brits were famously racist against South Asians. They were anti-Semites. But black people, again, were not present in sufficient numbers in those days to evoke any kind of marked response.
Right. And I mean, there's lots of discussion among scholars about projects in the 19th century of Russifying different populations within the Russian Empire. And within Russia, there are arguments of what does it mean to be Russian? Is it simply converting to orthodoxy? So if you were a Muslim Tatar and you became Orthodox, were you Russian? Was it adopting the Russian language and manners? So there's a lot of nuance in this argument. We could easily spend a whole episode on this. But I'm curious about his the end of his fortunes in Imperial Russia. How do his fortunes come to an end, and what causes him to flee to Constantinople?
So his life curve, let's put it simply, kept rising during the 18 years that he spent in Russia from around 1900 to 1918. He began as a waiter. He wound up as an owner of various entertainment properties. In 1917, very early, he bought a block apartments in Moscow. He made a play for a famous property in St. Petersburg. He kept getting more and more successful. He was actually brought in to an honorary guild of merchants in Moscow in 1917. So he was embraced by the merchant community in a way that was really quite remarkable. The country itself was constantly deteriorating. Revolution of 1905, various terrorist assassinations and attacks on imperial figures. The country started to collapse during the First World War, the first revolution in 1917, the second one. So the country was collapsing around him. When the Bolsheviks took over, they nationalized all the properties that Thomas owned. They just took it away from him. And he was allowed only to run a small canteen, a small cafeteria for theater workers. Then he found out in 1918 that he was on a list to be arrested. Why? Well, for the reason I mentioned. He was a representative of the propertied bourgeois class that the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, were trying to limit and actually started destroying. So he escaped with most of his family to Odessa on the shores of the Black Sea, which at that time was occupied by the Germans for various geopolitical reasons. And it was a safe haven from the Bolsheviks. He thought he would be able to stay there, safe from the Bolsheviks. He had property down there too. But as we know, the Bolsheviks eventually took over the entire territory of the former Russian Empire, and he had to flee, because if he stayed, they likely would have killed him, as they killed lots of representatives of the bourgeoisie. And the one place he could get away to, if he was on the shore of the Black Sea, was Constantinople, because, as I mentioned, the Allies had taken it over. So he fled for his life. He tried to do the best he can. He arrived in Constantinople, as he remembered, with about $25 in his pocket, and he was worth millions in contemporary dollars at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. In other words, if you convert the monies that he had and the properties that he owned in the contemporary monies, he was a rich man. Life was very tough for him, but he had a skill that Constantinople at that point in its history needed. The city was occupied by the Allies. And that meant that there were thousands of British, American, French, and Italian soldiers, sailors, officers, businessmen, and diplomatic types who flooded into the city. I mean, you know that the plan was to dismember the Ottoman Empire and make Constantinople into an international city, like Shanghai had been in China. And what do these men do when they're on leave or their offices are closed? They want to find some kind of wine, women, and song type of entertainment. And there was probably nobody in Constantinople in 1918 who knew more about how to do this kind of thing than Frederick Thomas, because of the experience he had had with his theaters and nightclubs in Moscow. So he managed to borrow money and open his first entertainment garden, which was an outdoor place that could only run during the warm weather. It was a great success. It drew in crowds of people. That's where the Russian singer, whom I mentioned at the very outset, whose remarks got me interested in Thomas to begin with, performed for him, a place called Stella. Anyway, one thing led to another. Thomas managed to find an indoor location. If you know Istanbul, as I know you do, it was right off Taksim Square, underneath the Majestic Theater, which has since been torn down, and a Sofitel hotel has been built in its place, but it's really beautifully located, and they preserve the facade of the old Majestic Theater. Because of the slope of the land, the basement space of this theater actually had a beautiful terrace with views of the Bosporus, and that's where he opened the celebrated nightclub Maxim, which became the toast of the city for the next half dozen years.
I'd love to hear what it was like for these years and for, I mean, listeners to give some context. As you mentioned, this is after the Ottoman Empire's defeat in World War I, and the loss was more catastrophic than any loss really in the history of the Ottoman Empire. They completely lose their Arabian land holdings. The border goes up to what modern day Turkey is. At the time, their European powers are negotiating the Treaty of Sevres, which means that in the east, most of the land of the Ottoman Empire will go to Russia. The western coasts that include modern-day Izmir will go to Greece. Part of it will go to France, and part of it will go to Italy. As you mentioned, Constantinople would be an international city managed by the British. Turkey, or the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, would be sort of a pathetic rump land that would exist in Anatolia. And modern-day Turkey, had this trajectory played out, would look like a nation in the Caucasus that we mostly overlook on our maps, like Georgia or Armenia, not to besmirch those nations, of course. And at this time period, it's very chaotic. It's hard for historians. Many of them skip over this period, which honestly I did, just because there's so many moving parts. The government is in massive flux. So please tell me about this period. For these years, what is it like at this time period? What in his nightclub? So I'd love to dwell on this.
Well, he was in a kind of a cultural, political, geographical oasis, because he was in Constantinople that was overseen by the victorious Allies, who had joint military patrols, sort of like Berlin at the very end of the Second World War before the Soviets tried to limit Allied access to it. And so he was in Pera, as Beyoğlu was called in those days, which is the older European part of the city. That's where the foreign embassies were. That's where the foreign stores were. That's where a lot of the Europeans settled or spent time. And he created a very elegant nightclub called Maxim, named after the Maxim he had in Moscow, which in turn was named after the Maxim in Paris. But in those days, every major city had a Maxim in imitation of Paris. He introduced jazz to Turkey. And actually, for this reason, he's still remembered by aficionados of jazz in Turkey. I think it was in 1919 that he first put on a jazz act in his club. I remember being in touch about this with Henry Louis Gates Jr., the well-known African-American professor at Harvard who has studied the history of Black people abroad in detail. And he was surprised that jazz was performed as early as that in Constantinople, because of course it conquered the world. But it happened a little bit later, as far as he knew. At any rate, jazz immediately caught on. There were other kinds of music that Thomas had performed. He had traveling Black American and European musicians, singers, and dancers performing on the stage of his nightclub, he served up a refined Franco-Russian cuisine. He served top-notch liquor. One of the wonderful acorns I dug up in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, was a stack of about 40 bills from a liquor wholesaler where Thomas bought the wine and spirits that he served to his clients. And this was all preserved in the American Consulate General. It was all preserved in the archives because the wholesaler wasn't paid on time and he came to the Consulate General to get help. But I could recognize all the brands and all the vintages that Thomas served. And that correlates with memories of how elegant his place was. So that a figure that I'm sure you know from that time, from the late teens, early 20s, Admiral Mark Bristol, who was the top-ranking American naval figure in Constantinople, in charge of the flotilla of naval ships that were in the harbor, and also the top diplomatic figure of the American government in Constantinople. In other words, an unimpeachable kind of figure. He and his wife regularly went to Maxim to have dinner, to have drinks, and to dance. So Thomas was blessed with the highest kind of approval of the Allies, and he thrived under them. But everything changed when the Allies were chased out. In 1923, the Republic was proclaimed. Ataturk chased the Greeks out. The Ottoman Empire was still dismembered, right? Those ridiculous straight lines that we see on maps of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, those were the lines drawn by European diplomats with rulers without any kind of concern of who lives where, which is why, for example, there are Kurds living in three different countries now and causing all kinds of trouble for the Turks and everybody else because they want their own independence. At any rate, none of that concerned Thomas. It was in Constantinople. In 1923, the Turks take over, and his protection from the Turks winds up being severely curtailed. The Americans also wash their hands of him. He couldn't prove to them that he was an American citizen once upon a time. That, of course, was a purely racist reaction to him on the part of the State Department, which adjudicated these matters. He tried to get an American passport. They wouldn't give him one. So he did the best he could for a while, having a kind of Turkish cover from partners. And then the competition in the kind of entertainments that he staged got too severe for him to be able to fight it. He went bankrupt. He lost his properties, was imprisoned, and died of pneumonia in 1928 in a nasty old prison in Istanbul. And he's buried in Istanbul in the Catholic cemetery, which I visited when I was doing research. And I found in their record books of burials the fact that he was buried there. But there is no grave marker because he was destitute and it costs money to put up a tombstone or something. So my hope is actually at some point, with the help of some people that I know who are interested in this, to put up a commemorative plaque on the wall of the cemetery, simply to mark that this remarkable man was buried there somewhere, although exactly where we don't know.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, something that is in common with a couple of your books is looking at figures who sort of ended up, I guess we could say, on the wrong side of different revolutions. And because of that, they're not well known. In a way, I'm surprised that Frederick Thomas wasn't recognized and claimed as someone to join in the success of the Turkish Revolution, because with Ataturk and the Turkish Republic, he had to initiate massive social change. And he realized that the Ottoman Empire simply didn't function and couldn't be successful in the 20th century. So among the many reforms pushed by Ataturk and other reformers around him were language reforms. The Turkish language uses Latin characters instead of Arabic characters. The religious laws that had guided a lot of the Ottoman Empire were done away with. Sharia law was completely abolished, replaced with secular law. Constitutional rights were granted. Women were granted the right to vote. The first female fighter pilot was actually Ataturk's adopted daughter, Sabiha Gökçen, of which you can fly into her airport in Istanbul. And I mean, but with an Ataturk as well, he dressed in European fashion. He abolished the fez. He enjoyed opera and the accoutrements of European civilization, drinking as well. He loved to drink and died of cirrhosis of the liver. So I would think that if I were Atatürk, oh, this is a black man who runs a jazz club. He is able to funnel in European culture into Istanbul, the most populous city in my new republic. So I would want him. In fact, I'm going to allocate funds to give him his own jazz club in my new capital of Ankara. Why did you think, in my mind, that's why I think he'd be perfect for the new republic, but he wasn't. So why did he fall out of favor?
You made several really important points. Yes, the way that Thomas made his living really did resonate with the secularization enterprise that Atatürk was advancing. This business of a place to which men and women could come and where they could mix easily and where they could dance together and where they could drink alcohol was very much in keeping with what Atatürk was trying to get the Turks to do as well. I mean, there's a famous anecdote that I'm sure you've come across when Atatürk tried to organize a ball and had his officers present, and the Turkish ladies wearing Western garb was standing on the other side of the hall, and nobody was doing anything to the music until he said that it is not the case that any lady would dare to refuse the hand of one of my officers if he asked her to dance. His roundabout way of getting these people to actually dance in a Western style. So yes, Thomas, what he did for a living, advanced the cause that Atatürk advocated. But my sense is that there was a kind of xenophobia is probably too strong a way to put it, but a kind of a reaction against the privileges that foreigners had been given in Ottoman Turkey. Thomas was by this point a stateless American. His biggest competitors were Italian businessmen who took over one of the old imperial palaces on the banks of the Bosporus with the Turkish government's permission and transformed it into a gigantic casino and entertainment complex that eclipsed Thomas's Maxim, and that these Italian entrepreneurs wanted to make a rival for Monte Carlo. But then the Turkish authorities found pretexts to shut it down. And I think it was because these were foreigners, and even though they were taxed, they were still not doing what presumably Turks should be doing in their stead. And also because there was a kind of a moralistic streak. The casino that the Italians operated was allowed to serve only foreigners. Turks were not allowed to go into it. Same kind of thing with Monte Carlo. The Monegasques can't go into the casino there. So on the one hand, it was a desire to limit the influence of foreigners. On the other hand, there was a kind of a desire to perhaps keep the Western forms of dissipation from affecting the Turks. The Maxim nightclub that Thomas had in Istanbul that he lost to his creditors survived. It was resurrected immediately after he was imprisoned. It became known as the Yeni Maxim. I don't know any Turkish except for a few words, and Yeni means new. So it continued to be a venue for jazz, but it was in Turkish hands. So maybe that was the problem. Because, you know, the capitulations that existed prior to the Turkish Republic allowed foreigners in Turkey to be judged by their own courts, not by Turkish law. And this probably rubbed a lot of the nationalistic Turks the wrong way, especially Turks of Atatürk's generation, who saw what the foreigners had in mind for his country, the kind of dismemberment that you described. So I suspect it was, another bit of evidence of this is Pera, what Beyoğlu used to be called, was filled with foreign enterprises where all the store signs were in French or English, German, briefly in Russian. After the Republic was proclaimed, it was made into a law that all shop signs had to be in Turkish, and if you had a foreign language in the shop sign as well, it had to be significantly smaller than was the foreign language. So I think it's another bit of evidence of the fact that the Turks by this point had had it with kowtowing to the West and wanted their own people to be able to do what was important for the country.
That's very interesting, and I could see how he would be on the wrong side of a lot of things, because as you mentioned, with capitulation treaties that the Ottoman Empire had with the West, diplomats had tax-free privileges, and they were selling these openly to Western merchants. the British government essentially controlled the domestic economy of the Ottoman Empire because the Ottoman Empire was in such heavy debt that it could be leveraged in that way. So Turkey, in its early history, was aggressively isolationist to try to push back against this trend. And even up into the 21st century, there's a strong sense in the history that Turkey presents about itself of opportunistic Westerners trying to take advantage of it, which definitely has historical foundation. But I think that still affects a lot of people's thinking. And some of the racial understandings entered Turkey as well in the 20th century, where there's a large standard deviation of your average Turkish phenotype, where people can look Central Asian, since there were a lot of Central Asian immigrants to Turkey, and a lot of Muslim groups resettled in Turkey from the Balkans, from the Crimea and elsewhere, all the way to people looking almost Western European Caucasian. So there's racial diversity in Turkey, but in the early 20th and mid 20th century, Turks really wanted to think of themselves as white. So I don't know if that affected the fate of Frederick Thomas as well, but that was at least a factor of the early Turkish Republic.
Yeah, I think actually Thomas arrived in Turkey from the Russian Empire, where I said his color was not marked. I think the case was, it was probably even easier for him in Turkey because, as you said, the Ottoman Empire spanned an enormous geographic space and an enormous variety of types of people. There were Africans who had very high positions in the Ottoman court. I remember reading that, I think it was in the 1960s, that the Black American writer James Baldwin went to Istanbul. And he was surprised and pleased to discover that there was no specific term for a Black person similar to what quote-unquote Negro meant in the United States in modern Turkish. And he was obviously very sensitive about the issue of being a Black man because of all the racism that he had encountered in the United States. And it was even more so the case, I think, when Thomas got there in 1919. There was no term comparable to Negro, the historical term, in Turkish at that time. And there was not even in the 1960s, as I said, through James Baldwin. The way in which the Turks divided people was not by skin color, but by religion. If you were a Muslim, that was one thing. If you were a Christian, it was another. And if you were a Christian, nominally, and you were married to a white woman, which Thomas was, he arrived in Istanbul with his third wife. All three of his wives that he married in Russia were white women. The Turks didn't care. It wasn't a signifying phenomenon. It was for the Americans who were there. And he encountered all kinds of hostility from Americans at the consulate general because of the fact that he had a white wife. In fact, they refused to recognize her as his wife. They referred to her in insulting ways as the woman with whom you cohabit kind of thing. So I think that it's interesting also the different kinds of senses of race that Thomas experienced in his life, from the very marked racism of the United States to the very liberal attitude of the Western Europeans, the Russians as well, and then Constantinople. It really is a social construct, the way we now understand it. And it wasn't something that he faced. Now, did that change when, as you said, the Turks started to try to think of themselves as being a white people? I don't know how developed that was from 1923 through 1928. I mean, they were still dealing with the population mix that they had inherited from the Ottoman Empire. Maybe over time, the demographic of Turkey became more white. I don't know. I didn't encounter anything about that. There was no animus that I could see from the scant evidence that I had about these kinds of things regarding his being Black, except, again, from Americans. Not all of them. Admiral Mark Bristol was a very enlightened and liberal man, and he actually tried to help Thomas when he was in trouble and was being accused of taking advantage of his waitresses, which was an accusation that was made against Thomas by his enemies and that Bristol had investigated, and the investigation showed that this was not the case at all.
Well, I suppose we could say about Thomas that he succeeded wildly in empires and there's an interesting nostalgia for empires I've seen among some historians. I mean, obviously, they completely lack the human rights that we enjoy today, but there was a possibility of difference, and there wasn't a sort of a homogenous culture that was pushed on all citizens, but there were different groups of people that had a hub and spoke model from the emperor or the sultan or the czar at the center, and then the power emanating out from the power center or the palace or wherever to these groups. And so it allowed difference. And so for someone like Thomas, it sounded like he did well in places like this.
Yeah, he was lucky too. I mean, where he landed. And none of this would have been possible in the United States, of course. So that's one of the things that makes him so remarkable, so unusual. And it was just my good fortune that I stumbled across that comment in the singer's memoir, you know, a sentence. But that really caught my attention. And I was lucky that Thomas, this is an ironic way to put it, I was lucky that Thomas got into trouble as much as he did in Constantinople, because that's where all the paperwork that illuminated a great deal of his existence for me was from. If everything is fine, you don't leave a paper trail. But if there's trouble, you do. And so thanks to some unnamed secretary in the Consulate General, all that stuff was preserved.
I sympathize with Thomas. The laws there sometimes I think are intentionally ambiguous so that the police can get more kickbacks, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah.
Like I said at the beginning of this episode, I love stories like this because they make us think about the past in different ways. And for readers of your book, what do you hope that his life, how do you hope it will challenge our notions of the past, whether it's American history, Russian history, Ottoman/Turkish history? How do you hope that it changes our view?
The book has been out for a while, and what I've heard from readers is that a lot of them are sort of inspired by his example. What chance would one think a young black man in Cahoma County in Mississippi, which is part of the Delta, which has been called the southernmost place on earth in terms of everything that was wrong with the old American South, what chance would somebody like that have to become as rich and successful as Thomas did? You would have said none. But through a combination of determination, the example of his parents, which was important, and luck, he was able to achieve remarkable things. If an event is when you move across a semantic field, is the way a semiotician I like described it, is when you move into a complete different field from where you had been before. If that's what makes an event, Thomas's life was one of the most eventful I can think of. How many borders he crossed that seemed completely impossible. It's interesting also that his legacy lives on in a way. I didn't mention this before, but when I was doing my research, I discovered that one of his sons wound up making it to France before the Second World War. And that son had a son, and that grandson of Frederick Thomas is a man about my age. And I interviewed him when I first came across this topic. A very nice man. He was very hospitable to me. He told me, this is a digression from what you asked about, but maybe it's worth telling. He told me what he knew about his grandfather's life, all of which I recorded with the grandson's permission, because I was just at the outset of my research. And that included some really remarkable stories, such as that Frederick Bruce Thomas was actually the favorite son of a chief of a Native American tribe in the Southwest, and that he began his career as a merchant seaman, and that he got to Russia because he saved the life of a rich Russian in a bar in Shanghai. Now, I didn't mention any of these things before, and that's because when I did my research, I discovered that all of them were inventions. So the story of Thomas's life, as it was preserved in his own family, by his son and by his grandson now, and by that grandson's own children, because he has children of his own, bears no great relation to what actually happened. That was another aspect of this entire endeavor that was extremely interesting to try to unravel and to understand. You know, why would Thomas's son, once he made it to the West in France, develop a story like this about his father? Surely he knew the truth. And I think that the answer was that it's easier to imagine that your ancestor was a free Native American than to think that he was the child of enslaved African Americans. And that underscores again what it is that makes Thomas so remarkable, given his past, that he was able to overcome those shackles of history and to become the kind of amazing success story that he was when he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, not once, but twice, in Moscow the first time, and then after losing everything, in Constantinople the second time. So perhaps that's the example to be drawn from his life, if one wants examples. I just found him absolutely fascinating to study and to find information about. So it's a great story for that reason, too, I think.
Well, some might chide him for fictionalizing his past. Some might call him a fabulous, but one man's fabulous is another man's dreamer who's also willing to rewrite his future, which probably explains a lot about his story.
Yeah.
Well, this is very interesting. And for listeners who want to read more about it, the name of the book is The Black Russian, which, as you said, is widely available. And this is not a secret because it's on your website, but is being optioned as well. So I really hope we can see it on the screen.
Yeah, that's a very promising development. And as I mentioned, a lot of books get optioned. Very few get made into TV series or films. But the signs in this particular case are very promising. And in fact, the producer who is interested in this, and the details of this are on my website, was drawn to the story because it is so unlikely for somebody with this background to have achieved everything that he did. He likes stories like that. And so that's what he wants to put on the screen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing this story with us, and I hope to have you on next time when your next book comes out. So, Vladimir, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Take care.
All right. That is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.